This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I am your host, Miriam Atkin. So for this month's show, I'll be doing something different. I'm extremely busy this month, and I just couldn't get around to preparing for a typical interview. And so what I'm going to do is share some interviews with artists that I admire. So the first one is a 1988 interview with William S. Burroughs conducted by Kathy Acker. And it's in honor of the opening of his show at the October Gallery. And if you so desire, you can watch it at UbuWeb. In case you don't know who they are, I'll read out some brief bios for them. Novelist, essayist, and performance artist Kathy Acker was born and raised in New York City. She was educated at Brandeis University and the University of California at San Diego, where she earned her BA. Black Mountain poet Charles Olson and novelist William S. Burroughs were great influences on Acker. She is also linked to the New Narrative Movement, initiated in the late 1970s by writers Robert Gluck and Bruce Boone in San Francisco. New Narrative sought to genuinely portray personal experiences and embraced a nuanced, authentic storytelling approach, rejecting absolute objectivity and fluidity in text meanings. Acker composed genre-crossing work in which she frequently appropriated, reshaped, interrupted, and modified other texts to explore the intersections of sex, power dynamics, and the intricacies of language. Acker died of cancer in 1997. William Seward Burroughs was an American writer, visual artist, spoken word performer, and chaos magician, credited as a primary figure of the Beat Generation and a major postmodern author who influenced popular culture and literature. Burroughs wrote 18 novels and novellas, 6 collections of short stories, and 4 collections of essays. 5 books have been published of his interviews and correspondences. He also collaborated on projects and recordings with numerous performers and musicians and made many appearances in films. He was also briefly known by the pen name William Lee. Burroughs created and exhibited thousands of paintings and other visual artworks, including his celebrated shotgun art. Jack Kerouac called Burroughs the greatest satirical writer since Jonathan Swift. He owed this reputation to his lifelong subversion of the moral, political, and economic systems of modern American society, articulated in often darkly humorous sardonicism. So here we go.
I'm here in the October Gallery with the first exhibition in England of William Burroughs' paintings and with Mr. Burroughs himself. And I wanted to start asking you about the paintings. Is this a recent development in your work, or have you done work like this simultaneously with your writing?
Well, I started doing montages with Brian Geisen. Brian Geisen in 1959 said that writing is 50 years behind painting, and he applied some of these techniques. We were using montages, making montages for scrapbooks since the very early 60s. So it's not a new development in that sense, but what you see here is a new development dating back to 1982.
Right. In a certain area of your work, especially in Nova Express and The Ticket That Exploded, you and some of the smaller works, you talked a lot about the methods of cut up and the fold-in method and other methods. Is the montage that you're doing these pictures, does the procedure resemble some of the methods back in those days?
It does, very definitely, in that the cut up introduced into writing a random factor, a cut of the scissors.
Right.
And here we have, in some cases, the blast of a shotgun producing an explosion of color, either hitting a tube of paint or a can of spray paint, which produces an explosion of color across the surface of quite unpredictable patterns. But this, of course, is not such a new thing in painting. It was done by Pollock, by Eve Klein, and I'm sure by others, letting paint drip down the canvas to form these random, unpredictable patterns. That doesn't rule out very careful brushwork. I think Pollock was a very careful artist, too. There's no contradiction there. You may simply use your drip canvas or your surface covered with color by a shotgun blast as a background for brushwork and silhouette work.
Do you feel, it's funny because that puts you in the abstract expressionist tradition, but do you feel that that's how you've worked on your books also? This combination of almost shotgun blast and very careful use of language.
Well, but there is no real equivalent for
right.
a shotgun
that's what I was
blast
asking, yeah.
On paper. There's no way you could do it. The cut-up method is, it introduces a random factor, but it isn't at all on the scale of an explosion.
Well, for you, is visual thinking different from verbal thinking?
Well, I don't think they're separable. It's like a film script. You have movement and you have words. You have action and you have words. And you are a writer, I think, is seeing a film. At least I am seeing a film when I write, and then I try to get that film across to the reader to make him see what I'm seeing in the film.
Right. Well, let me...
Him or her.
Let me come back to this, but I want to start off with some of the early work. I want to ask you, everyone has written, and there's a lot of history in the libraries and whatnot about your connection with the Beats back in the early days. But how did you actually start writing? When and why?
I really started writing in... let's see, when was it... Well, 51, my first book, Junkie, was written at that time. And that would be, I was in my, about 34, 30, 35 years old, very late for most people. Well, there had been some sporadic attempts before that. Kells Elvins and I wrote a short story together called Twilight's Last Gleamings, which has been one of the... one of my more popular numbers for reading, for readings. And that was in 1938. No one wanted to publish it. They even wrote us special letters of rejection.
Why did you start writing?
Well, there's no reason why one starts writing. They asked Genet, when did he start writing? And he said, at birth.
Were you influenced by other writers?
Oh, well, heavens, yes, that's a very important part of the writer's input, his other writers. Conrad, very strong, Kafka, Graham Greene, of course, Shakespeare, Rambo, Saint-Jean-Pierre, Baudelaire.
So Junkie and Queer were fairly... almost so socio-realistic novels. They were written with a very linear sort of narrative.
Yes.
And there was a big change between them and Naked Lunch.
Yes.
What, first of all, what was the process of writing Junkie and Queer? Did you write those?
Well, it was very, pretty simple. Someone suggested that, Junkie was written first, that I should just write up my experiences
right.
With addiction. So I just sat down and reconstructed more or less in a straight journalistic style the experience.
Right.
The experiences. There was a little moving around of one thing from here to here, but by and large, pretty much straight narrative. Queer was much more, much less journalistic and more personal. But you see, there was a long gap between. Between Queer, Junkie, Oh Yahe Letters, of course. That was in 1962.
Right.
But between that and the publication of Naked Lunch is, Naked Lunch was published in 19... 1959 in Paris by the Olympia Press.
Right.
So that's a gap of more than 7 years.
It took a while for Naked Lunch to get published, though, didn't it?
Well, we had made several attempts. We'd had many rejections of the manuscript, but it really wasn't in a definite shape.
Right.
At that point. Now, Maurice Gerodius of Olympia had turned it down when he first saw it about 2 years before 1959. And then there was an argument with the editors of the Chicago Review and the Board of Trustees, who didn't want them to publish Kerouac or Dahlberg or myself. So they resigned en masse and formed this magazine, Big Table.
Ah, that's when Big
Table,
oh, okay.
Yes, that, yes. So when Maurice heard about this, he said, oh, it sounds like scandal, which he does.
Yeah.
And he sent someone over from the office, Sinclair Bayliss, in fact, came to my room and said that Maurice now wanted to publish this novel, Naked Lunch, and he needed the manuscript in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a mass of notes, perhaps 1,000 pages of notes, some of it in pretty good shape, particularly, of course, the sections that appeared in Big Table were all ready to go.
Right.
So with the help of Brian Geisen, Alan Sinclair, we got the manuscript ready in 2 weeks. And as we were completing a section, we'd send it to the printer, who didn't read English, incidentally, and made fewer mistakes in consequence. So we thought we'd, you know, sort out the order later. But when it came back to the printer, we took one look and said, well, the present order is perfect. Yeah, the only one change was made was that the what was the beginning then became the end. The two detectives walking in became the end of the book instead of the beginning. And that was the only change that was made in this more or less arbitrary order, not random, but arbitrary.
I want to ask you about your process of writing it. What I've heard, and I don't know if it's an apocryphal story, is I know that you have many files and collect information, that you had bits of information pasted up over the walls and you'd go from bit to bit, and that's apocryphal.
See,
how did you compose it?
In the first place, I wasn't into the cut-up method at that time at all.
Okay.
I knew nothing about that. And I was not paying any particular attention to newspaper articles and pictures. That came later, this interest in juxtapositions and newspaper and magazine articles and the collages. I just wrote it in sort of short bursts of 3, 4, 5 pages as it came to me.
Now, between Naked Lunch and the Nova Express Ticket That Exploded period, what happened to the process of writing?
Well, principally the cut-up method.
Right.
Which was Brian's idea. And I applied it with great enthusiasm, and I think in some cases carried it too far. Writers can get carried away by a technique, and what they can do with this technique and carry it so far that they lose their readers. And I think this happened to some extent in those three books, The Ticket That Exploded, Nova Express, and The Soft Machine. There were many additions to The Soft Machine.
I have.
So that the, between the English and the American edition, I think there's about 30 or 40 extra pages in the the complete edition, the British edition.
The British is complete? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh.
And when I told the Grove Press, who was about to reissue the book about this, they just weren't interested at all.
Really?
No.
Oh, I'll talk to
well,
Fred
they
about
felt
that.
That, you know, people were used to one version, and to say that this contains new material is not particularly an
no, that's quite
inducement.
Wrong.
Well, that was their attitude anyway, so I just said, well, we'll forget it.
Are they reprinted yet?
Oh, yes, this was some time ago.
Oh, this was some time ago. Okay, that was when Grove was floundering. But, well, first of all, when did you meet Brian? And how did you meet Brian?
I met Brian in Tangiers in 1954. He was giving an exhibit of his paintings at the Rembrandt Hotel. And I went to the exhibit, and we talked a while, but we were not all congenial
right.
at that time. He subsequently opened a restaurant called The 1001 Nights, and I used to eat there occasionally with, well, it was very good food, and he had dancing boys, and he got a lot of very chic clientele. But I didn't get to know him at all.
Right.
It was only later in Paris that I ran into him in 1958. And then he showed me his pictures, and I really began to see his pictures.
Right.
He taught me how to see a picture. Then we became very close friends.
When you started doing the cut-up method, were there any political... There's a lot of discussion in, say, Nova Express about the word as virus and the necessity to destroy the word. What were the, if any, the political ramifications? Were there?
Well, there are no political ramifications that could be put into, fitted into any party.
Right.
There's no affiliations with socialism, communism, or certainly not. Or capitalism.
They're, right.
There are no direct political affiliations.
Well,
the whole thing is a mess. That's the point. In that
you
way,
seemed,
in that way, political, yes.
Well, you talked about the word as a method of control.
Mm.
And that the cut-up of the word in some way would get rid of the control. Do you still feel that?
Well, it's not completed. Not completely at all. I mean, it's
right.
just a... may loosen up this automatic association of word and of word and what the word refers to. Well, you get these vague words like communism and capitalism. You have as many definitions as there are people who use them. There's total confusion. And that confusion is largely verbal. I studied with Korzybski, the founder of general semantics and anti-Aristotelian logic. And he says that one of the basic errors of Western thought is either or, something that either instinctive or intellectual, either hereditary or environment. This split, which of course does not exist, in
right.
fact, it's both and.
I know that at least part of your writing has been involved with non-dualistic systems. When did you get involved with Scientology?
That was around 68, around in there, 65. I wanted to see what they had to say. Brian knew some of the early Scientologists, and he in fact had stayed with them in Algiers during the Civil War. So he told me about Scientology, said they have this system they think will take over the planet, and he says it has a certain interest. Said they say it works. He said, I wouldn't say that it works, I'd say that it does something.
What,
and that was my experience, yes. I went into it and became what they call a clear.
What's a clear?
Well, a clear is someone that, whose engrams have all been erased.
Right.
Engrams being words and images stored in periods of pain and pain and unconsciousness, like in an operation. And he said no one should ever talk during an operation because the patient is hearing it. And your negative comment can have very devastating
right.
results. Well, this actually has been borne out. And they have, they're playing back tapes. They found that the person showed a great anxiety if there was something that keyed in.
Right.
Keyed in the operation, that is, even the sound of an instrument dropping or something of that sort, and words particularly. So they have in many hospitals an absolute rule, no talking, no joking in the operating room.
This is probably another apocryphal story. I had heard, I think Miles told me, that you once disguised yourself as a plumber, went into the Scientology offices and stole some files.
Absolutely, without the slightest foundation.
I've heard a lot of apocryphal stories. You've also been involved in some other methods of training. The one I know about is a bit with Trungpa Rinpoche.
I was not involved with Buddhism.
Right.
I know a little bit about it, and Alan is very much into it, but it doesn't attract me too much. I've never really practiced meditation. I did take a course with the S people.
You did?
Yeah, but it was already a splinter group in London. I forget who, but it seems helpful. You get some interesting things from the...
From what, if any, other similar sources have you gotten information?
Well, those are the Scientology and S were the two, whatever you call them.
Right.
Systems that
I... Systems, training schemes, I don't know.
Went into.
When did your interest in Egyptology start?
Years ago, I've always been interested in the idea of a pictorial language. I remember I was staying in Chicago, and I was living in Chicago in 1943 or 44. I started to take a course in Egyptian writing. And I did get some distance with it. I had Gardner's Egyptian grammar and wrote out these exercises. And very interesting, because it can be read immediately. It doesn't have the same linear quality.
In the most recent book, The Western Lands, which I've only, I must say, partly read so far, in the middle of, it seems to me to be somewhat a meditation on death, based on a lot of the old Egyptian schemas. How helpful do you actually find that information?
How what?
Helpful do you actually find that? I mean, how seriously?
I think it's quite a helpful concept, the seven soul concept. Explains a lot. Of course, it's obvious that there's not much unity, but see, you have seven souls, and their interests at some point are irreconcilable. They do not have the same interests. This creates difficulties. Yes.
Would that be a sort of more complicated schema of when you talked a little about RM and about the centers that in which we oppose ourselves, we stop ourselves from, I'm not putting this very clearly, stop ourselves.
Well, yes, you would say that the existence of entities with divergent interests is going to make someone seem to be self-defeating in many instances.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get is there seems to have been a major change in your work between the Nova Express period and the later books, both stylistically and in terms of preoccupation, that in the Nova Express books you were being concerned with cut-up, you were also concerned with attacking various systems of control, both political in terms of the RM or whatever, the ways, and politically in terms of the use of word to control. And after that, say, in The Wild Boys and later on, the novels stylistically became more narrative, but more important for me, you seem to be concerned with how humans could get out of the predicament in which they were in. And at what caused that change in preoccupation, first of all?
Well, that would be too complicated even. you know, what causes a change in of that sort usually does not have a definite answer. But given the change occurring, then the content will dictate a straight narrative.
Right.
If you're talking about pirates or guerrilla bands, you have to preserve a line of straight narrative in order to present your material.
Did you feel at all that the cut-up wasn't working? I mean, because obviously things change as environments change, and politically and historically, the United States and the Western world has changed greatly since 58 in the early 60s. Did you feel that the cut-up was no longer viable?
Not necessarily. It's a technique.
Right.
And like any technique, it works here and it doesn't work somewhere else, that's all. Like painting techniques.
When did you start thinking about the relationship of space to time?
Well, it's as soon as I thought about either one, because there's obvious. The obvious relationship, of course, how long does it take you to get from here to here?
Right. Who, at that point, when you were thinking in terms of space travel, whose work were your reference? What were your references in?
Well, from childhood, I used to read amazing stories, science fiction. I read Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells still stands up pretty good. I reread The Time Machine not long ago. Interesting.
What other writers do you read? I know you read a lot of science fiction.
Yes, quite a bit of science fiction. I read spy stuff, Le Carré, Forsyth, Len Deighton. I've read a lot of doctor books. It's a regular genre, as you know.
Yeah.
Very, very... very popular, The Making of a Surgeon and Dr. X. Started with Dr. X.
Yes, I know those.
So those are largely read for information. And I started out to be a doctor.
You did? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Was that what you studied at Harvard?
No. I started out in Vienna because they didn't require any pre-medical work.
Hmm.
Well, it's just as well it didn't work out. So medicine has always been one of my interests. Hobbies, you might say.
Well, I remember seeing you on Saturday Night Live once.
Mm.
And very strong when you said, "I'm the doctor," and the TV camera came in on your face. But I keep trying to, you know, sort of press over to this area, and I don't really know how to get to it. You obviously feel that things are in a bad way, politically, or in the world. I use the word politically very generally. I don't mean in terms of parties.
Disastrous way.
To what extent do you think it's possible for us to save ourselves?
An impossible question to answer. Who do you mean by us? And who do you mean by ourselves? I don't subscribe
Would that
to
be
the
an
idea.
Answer?
I don't I mean, subscribe to the idea that there's any such thing as human nature, humankind.
Right.
And I feel very little even empathy with most people. So when you speak of a we, it would be a pretty small we. Most we's you can include me out of. But Korzybski, it's one of the important things he points out, that the, not to use generalities, we, the American people,
right.
The consensus of informed opinion. Oh, wow. Well, someone says the consensus of informed opinion, you know you're going to hear some real nonsense.
And yet your books are all about survival.
Well, all right. There's one possibility would be escape from the planet. For a few people.
Right. Do you think of this escape literally or in terms of altering perception?
Well, they're the same thing. If you alter your perception, then you have altered your location, your space-time location.
Are your books in any way methods for altering perception?
as far as they can be.
Yeah. How far do you think literature can work in that area?
Well, that's it, as far as it can go, and the same way with painting.
Do you think they work in the same ways?
Well, no, not quite.
It's a little
the
what
same
I was trying
way.
To get at the difference.
It's not quite the same way, but Gerald Wells said that any painting of consequence you can read. In other words, there's a story in it, not a message, not
right.
a message, but a story. And in the same way, writing, the more visual, the better, I feel. So they're both attempting the same thing.
Well, I guess one final question. Is The Western Lands your final book, or are you writing
another? Oh, I'm working on another. I'm writing one about Jesus Christ now.
You are?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of notes.
My mouth is open in astonishment. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I'm sorry we don't have time to get into Jesus.
I'd love to. Do we have time? I was signaled.
Well.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Okay, tell me about it.
Well. To begin with, it's neither the rationalist approach. People are saying now that Jesus didn't exist. It was a whole retroactive construct of the church. I am convinced on aesthetic grounds that he did exist, because the whole gospel has the mark of one man talking, just as Shakespeare's plays
do. Right.
Whoever wrote them, it was written by one person, Shakespeare. And I'm convinced personally that Shakespeare wrote them. And the same is true of Jesus. Now, did he perform any of these miracles? Undoubtedly, he performed some of them. But that is not so remarkable. Any good magic man can cure the sick sometimes. Can't win them all. And many of them can cast out devils, particularly if they installed the devils in the first place. And I've seen some very impressive weather magic. There's quite a few practitioners who can do weather magic.
Yeah.
So they can do anything so terribly remarkable.
Yeah.
But the church then set up this miracle monopoly only by authorized personnel, by church personnel.
Right.
So that was one result of Christ, this miracle monopoly. The Buddhists take a very, very dim view of miracles and healing. They say if you can, don't.
Mm-hmm.
First place, you're upsetting the natural order with incalculable long-range consequences. And two, that the healer is often motivated by the most deplorable self-glorification and vanity.
Do you think that was true of Christ?
Well, he's... None comes to the Father except through me.
Yes. I see.
I think there's a degree of self-glorification involved.
Well, talking about morality, what do you think has happened? There seems to be a huge rise in institutionalized morality in the United States.
Well, symptom of fear, dislocation.
Right.
They don't know what's happening or where they are. They want something they can hang on to, I suppose. But remember that there's a terrific gap between doctrine and practices built into the Christian religion.
Yes.
Love your enemies and all that, which is biologic suicide put into practice. So no one puts it into practice or attempts to do so. So you have this gap between what people are supposed to do and what they actually do. Same, I think, is true of Mohammedism. Less true of Buddhism than of any of the other major religions.
Well, Buddhism isn't theistic.
Hmm?
It's not theistic. I mean, it's not about obeying one thing or one
Well, yes. Well, of course, then there are many schools of Buddhism.
Right.
So
Jesus Christ, in a way... What's he like in the book? I mean, is he someone who is trying to control?
Well, I don't think that's exactly. He wouldn't put it that way.
Mm.
But he does say, "None come to the Father except through me." In other words, he's the only one. Well, didn't Muhammad say the same thing? There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, one and only. Well, in my story, the Christ virus gets loose from the Museum of Extinct Species. So you have hundreds of thousands, millions of people going around saying, I am the way, none comes to the Father except through me, and getting inherits and even performing miracles. After all, special effects have come a long way since Christ, so.
What about Judas in the book? How does he come in?
Who?
Judas.
Well, he hasn't come in yet. I hadn't thought too much about him, but I'll get to him.
Sounds great. Oh, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Pleasure.
Yes.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. I find Kathy Acker to be very generous and patient in that interview. So maybe next time that I'm too busy to conduct my own interview, I'll play an interview with Kathy Acker. So we'll move on to the second interview. This one is with the poet Will Alexander, conducted by Douglas Manuel, also a poet. And it was organized by Poetry LA. You can watch the video on YouTube. And I'm going to begin by reading short bios for the interviewer and interviewee. Douglas Manuel was born in Anderson, Indiana, and now resides in Whittier, California. He received a BA in creative writing from Arizona State University, an MFA in poetry from Butler University, and a PhD in English literature from the University of Southern California. He's the author of two collections of poetry, Testify and Trouble Funk. A recipient of the Dana Giola Poetry Award and a fellowship from the Borchard Foundation Center on Literary Arts, he is an assistant professor of English at Whittier College and teaches at Spalding University's low-res MFA program. Will Alexander works in multiple genres. In addition to being a poet, he is also a novelist, essayist, aphorist, playwright, philosopher, visual artist, and pianist. His influences range from poetic practitioners such as Aimé Césaire, Bob Kaufman, André Breton, Antonin Artaud, and Philip LaMancha to the encompassing paradigm of Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga and the Egyptian worldview as understood by Sheikh Anta Diop and R.A. Schwaller de Lubish. The latter is central to Alexander's expanding inner range, which has allowed him access to levels of mind beyond the three-dimensional as boundary. He thereby explores the full dimensionality of each word. For him, the word has access to not only the median level of three-dimensional experience, but also partakes of experience on both the supra and subconscious planes. His praxis of language is not unlike the Mayan numerical world, where each letter of the alphabet spontaneously engages in non-limit. Thus, all fields of experience are open for exploration: art, physics, botany, history, astronomy, architecture, and poetics. Alexander's books include Asia and Haiti, the Sri Lankan Loxodrome, Compression and Purity, Sunrise and Armageddon, Diary as Sin, Inside the Earthquake Palace, Toward the Primeval Lightning Field, and Mirak Speaks to His Grammatical Transparence. He lives in Los Angeles. I should mention that this interview is focusing on what was Alexander's most recent publication at the time it was recorded in 2022, which was Refractive Africa, published by New Directions. And the interview begins with a brief reading from that text by Alexander.
The poem is over 50 pages, mm-hmm. So I'm not going to belabor the activity here. As Akashic Sangoma, I peer into the Congo. As transpersonal witness, as incisively faceted tiger, squirming, having the powers of a shark, via forces that sculpt the lenticular as lightning. perhaps a telepathic wakefulness, perhaps magisterial conjuration, creating migrational litmus in my blood, thereby knowing the dangerous template that is the Congo. Blood-infected, dazed conundrum, horrific with grandeur, solemnly lit by grinning episodes of lightning. Thus, duplicitous tragedy innate with microcentric suffering, its stressful indictment, its tertiary woundings, its camps, its darkened glossolalia at the height of bloody moonrise. As far as auric markings, I am never plagued by microtessellation, by extended physical armament, as if under siege listening to dysfunctional scallops. This being none other than spectral conflict consulted by looming sentiment, by the spectral inflame that allows the mind to consume itself as refraction, as a smoldering mental sea. Knowing resonance via Akashic transference, I spontaneously engage levitational fuels, therefore I engage magnetism and magically invade latitudes and formation. By astonishment, by conundrum, by circuitous circulation according to the realm of osmosis, not aligned to the institutional as drama. Via intuition, I leap to China and its pragmatic repression, its sociological deprecation. Therefore, I take issue with pragmatic epistles, mechanical as they are, with superimposed stasis conveyed as pointless equilibrium, always desirous of burning roads into swamps, placing taxable recognition on grain, or pulling wayward crops from earth. These are measures that suffocate the Congo with its intricate mysteriums so that we cultivate endemic demise, so that we cultivate infected tautology that bruise us as ventriloquial diamonds shattered in such a manner that we become studded with foreign domination that degrades according to wattage from Belgium, or entangled castles in Britain, or psychic swamps in the Vatican. And all of the above, sire, general psychic clotting, siring a nightmare of particulars, negatively alive with carnivorous anti-resonance, a resonance that reigns as compromised respiration, alive as the global Occident with its self-defaunation as fever, with its thought always active as befouled arrangement to percussive ostentation, as poisoned psychic fueled, as manufactured habitats, as emblematic dysfunction. I'll end it there for this first portion.
Awesome.
As I said, it goes on for many pages.
Well, thank you so much. Honestly, it's such a song of the Congo, such a recuperation of the Congo. So I think my first question, honestly, is why the Congo and why now for this text? Like, honestly, I feel as though we get so much when we think about post-colonial gazes, and we get so much of West Africa, we get so much of East Africa, but going to the Congo, what led you there?
It's heartbeat of the world.
Point well taken.
And it's never recognized as a central heartbeat.
Yes,
that's
yes.
An important point. I take all of the republics in the West, you know, the forces in the West, you know, mm-hmm. it's descended on the Congo. Actually, as I point out in my introduction to mm-hmm. the Refractive Africa, mm-hmm. it goes back to the Portuguese.
Yes.
You know, and King John, a little mm-hmm. prior to King John I, who was mm-hmm. the father of Prince Henry the Navigator.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Ceuta. Mm-hmm. In northern Africa, you know, the city's still there. I think it's in Morocco,
mm-hmm.
and as this momentum started, Henry took it over, and began sailing down the west coast of Africa,
mm-hmm.
and hence we have this embroilment that is still going on to this moment. It's out of the news, and all we hear about is Ukraine. Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
not that the Ukraine is a place to be eschewed, but mm-hmm. it is not the only circumstance in the world.
When I was in Eritrea in 2018, that like China's footprint as well in the Congo.
But because it's China, it's seen as having some benefit. There's no benefit to this because, and as I was some time back, the people in Malawi, for instance, did mm-hmm. not care so much for them coming in.
Right.
Because they understood that point,
mm-hmm.
that long historical point. So what I'm interested in is we're going to integrate the whole psychophysical global circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
We have to include, not exclude.
Yes.
So how many stories do we have on Congo? I mean, the Friends of the Congo, mm-hmm. you can Google this information, but it's not easy to come by.
And I think that's why this song ends up being so important of, like, you know, a poetry of witness to retell those stories. I remember, like, seeing that text, Leopold's Ghost, and, like, really hearing the kind of tragedies mm-hmm. and, like, the atrocities. And this text also gets to that and bears witness to that, too. And so could you talk about how that kind of pieces together in your whole kind of cosmology of work? Because I feel like you've always been singing the songs of the marginalized, but always singing it with like a prophet's passion. For how do you find what songs need to be sung at what moment? How do you get there?
Strictly intuition, almost. Not. It's not. I'm not colonized by cognitive expertise.
Oh my goodness, that's a great turn of phrase. Yes, I feel you. Yes,
not cognitive expertise, but mm-hmm. you know, I learned. There's Robert Frost who said one time, who, by the way, I'm not particularly enamored of, but
me neither.
but he had this one statement about the poet walks through a field of thorns with boots on,
yeah.
and he walks across this field and he picks up whatever is that the boots pick up on as he spontaneously, you know. ambulates to the field.
Yes.
So this is my natural method, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't pre-plan anything. In that sense, I don't owe Breton, but I'm naturally, like Cesare says, I'm naturally drawn to that, you know, because I have a non-linear mind just by nature.
I think for such a dense vocabulary, mm-hmm. the musical ear is still on point. Like when you're reading, like there's just moments almost as though it feels like it's being channeled. And I think it's a lot because of that repetition, like perhaps, perhaps, mm-hmm. and like just that kind of building of that kind of rhetorical flex. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, having listened to so much music.
Yes, yes.
And in particular, the perpetual avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
When they call it, I call it the perpetual avant-garde of, you know, listen to Eric Dolphy's Sister
Yes.
Taylor. However seemingly abstract this is, all these condensation points, because mm-hmm. the cosmos itself has balance and reason to mm-hmm. it, but not in a superficial manner. It's a continuous organicity. But because this continuous organicity has been disrupted, mm. by this colonization process,
mm-hmm.
energies that could be learned out of the cosmos don't have a filtering point on this earth. And this is one of the reasons why the condition that we're talking about here at this time is fragmented to such a degree that it leaves the leaders and all the politicians very confused, in Occident in particular. These systems are like scripted across long periods of time that the politicians very confused in Occident in particular. These systems are like scripted across long periods of time that the individual mind can't, for the most part, can't put their hands around it because you're mesmerized by recent thinking.
Yes, I'm with it.
The recent thinking is colonizes and opens up the mind to, it's an ironic statement, but it opens up the mind to restriction. The cognitive process of addition, mm-hmm. quantity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, more and more.
That René Guénon, the person that may not be known by many people, but he understood this in this book called The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times.
Mm-hmm.
the idea of quantity is overtaking all quality.
Yes.
That is always populating the consciousness of the everyday mind on a planetary scale.
No, seriously.
It's one of the contributing factors to our climate deficit.
Yeah.
One of the contributing factors.
Yes, yeah.
But it's the individuals piling up, but at the same time, this consciousness piles up junk.
Mm-hmm.
And if we see this, the situation with the low orbit of the satellites,
right?
These problem, these momentums, and I tell everybody that they should not lose their handwriting skills, because some of these things may not work out so well as we go into the deep future.
Just like, you know, the jazz musicians and used to find just these like little vocal phrasings and just these little like bites of sound. Mm-hmm. I feel like this little just like dense little units of language that you're able to work with. And I'm really interested in how you're able to, you know, English is like this inherited tongue, of course, of colonization, of slavery, and how you're able to use that tongue yet speak outside of that tongue and critique it.
English has been this is the dominant, so-called dominant language on the earth. And anywhere you go in the world, you can find somebody that'll, you know, speak with you. So it's not something that, as I point out at the beginning of the book, I'm using it to transfer power.
Well said.
In terms of the way it operates in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doing this as a scholar, as a certain expertise, but the way that you have, there's a space where you can begin to, how can I say, positively infect, positively infect other forms of consciousness. And see, enough people speak English so you can affect them on a global scale.
Yes.
You don't have to just limit yourself to the neighborhood, say the neighborhood I was raised in, or anybody was raised in. In other words, you can leap out of these little spaces, pre-stamped spaces that they psychologically colonize you in.
One of the things that this text does a lot too is to put like kind of two opposing forces next to each other and just sit there with that juxtaposition and just let go. And it feels as though almost like the paradox of the contradiction like ends up meaning more than just like saying something straight of like a straight indictment, like that capitalism doesn't work or colonialism's bad. Like
reality is complex, by the way. It's very complex, you know. And I got this originally when I was very, very young from a great, great little known giant, the great Booker Little, the great trumpeter, who talked about dissonance expanding sound, not reducing sound.
Oh, I can dig that. Dissonance expanding sound.
Dissonance expanding sound. So, in other words, this contradiction resolves. Someone was asking Eric Dolphy once about, music is, but he says, I'm expanding and I'm learning, I'm getting into this other activity of consciousness. And the people at the moment didn't understand properly what he was doing. Never did. And this is a big problem for the consciousness of the whole planet, because how many people know about these innovative thoughts?
Not enough.
And so it's minority issue, it's this, it's a minority consciousness. I was oppressed by this. And you just stay at that point. What about liberating yourself from that oppression psychologically?
Right. So how do you hold all of it? I mean, honestly, within like one turn of phrase, we can end up like from something as small as being on the tip of a finger to something as big as being on the edge of the horizon of, you know, a star breaking, back to like the tongue of, you know, the colonial speech in Belgium, to the native tongue in Africa, back to the griot. We can be all of that literally within like one stanza. How do you hold all that?
This is my natural, I don't get fatigued by it, but it,
that's amazing.
It opens me. It doesn't restrict me, you know, but that's just the way that my wiring works. But But if you look at the way that the mind can work, we can go further and further and further, advance and advance and advance in terms of the way we weaken the colonial psychological spell, the colonial
spell.
Can
you talk a little with the process? I want to be able to tap in too. Is it just through the writing and attending to this kind of spiritual practice of writing and seeing? Is it through hard looking? How can I find more room for things like that you have? Yeah. Again, like there's so much. It feels like that you can't be full.
You don't want to retain things.
Wow. Okay. I can dig it.
People want to retain and memorize the mm-hmm. old. Mm-hmm. I think Goethe said that the West, and I'm just paraphrasing.
Oh, no. Yeah. And I'm just trying to soak it all in.
Talked about the whole idea of not being able to advance beyond repetition. Mm. Of repeating yourself mm-hmm. to get to the point where you can illuminate yourself.
Let's go.
You're not eschewing history, but you're understanding there's something beyond regression of consciousness.
So going forward instead.
Yeah, going forward. And so one of my next works I'm working on now is called Anterior Wattage.
Anterior Wattage.
But it hasn't appeared yet, although I'm working on that scale of. You know, these general questions are asked by cosmologists. What happened before the Big Bang?
Right.
So I began to psychologically articulate this invisibility, this translucence, and via some time ago. And I've been working on that for like on a protracted at a protracted level, protracted scale. The power of the 2012 Mongova rape assaults, symbolic of the Congo with its bloody ossification, under the auspices of skeletal deliberation, with its armed and jealous judgments, bribery being our principal circumstance, primed via the authorized cosmology of death. Should I speak in Lingala or French or a formally interpreted English, the result being horror, the mind, blind eye of violence with its tempestuous gauge, sired by ferocity of silence. So as Sangoma, I listen in my sleep for ignited phonemes, for scratches of sound that issue from germinal graveyards, orally citing those who poach corpses for profit. So I, who have mastered certain phonemes from English and acquire from modern angst, its sullen contribution, so that its seizure relents concerning our mineral largesse, so that beings such as Dr. Makwege and Chakia Utomsi continue revealing our neo-humanity that forges beyond forbidden realms that supersede the aristocracy of diamonds. Mm. The whole idea of the complication.
Yes, yes.
Of all these different forces coming together. Mm-hmm. It's beyond the capability of what one is seemingly born with. You know? And even if you don't know something, mm-hmm. you exercise at that level to such a degree that these things become apparent, not in a rational way, but in a kind of the way that things percolate. Because most of the things that we know, all the things that we know were pre-human on this earth.
Yeah, being pre-memory.
Like a shamanistic understanding, mm-hmm. we increase our grammar, not in terms of rationality, but in terms of just the knowingness and the balance of the understanding.
Well, thank you for helping me increase my grammar. And thank you for helping all of us through your work increase our grammar. Thank you so much, seriously.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, there you have it, Will Alexander's Cosmology. Something nutritious for you to roll around in your brain on a Thursday morning. And that's it. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.